Today is Wednesday. It's March 9th, 2022, and it's 2:40 in the afternoon. Hi, it's John Williams. Thanks again for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast. And thanks for listening to me, if you do, weekdays on WGN from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the safely returned proprietor of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter.
Yeah, we followed Eric's trip down south. All right, let's start with this today, guys. Gas prices are on the rise, and it does not look like they're going to go down anytime soon. The average price of a gallon of gas in America today is $4.25. Some stations in Los Angeles and San Francisco have touched $7 a gallon. So we are past the record prices set in 2008. But you know, those numbers are not adjusted for inflation in most of the reports. So $4.11, which was the old record then, is $5.37 a gallon now. And shouldn't that be the way that gets reported? I know people are feeling higher gas prices, but I'm also just kind of annoyed at how much reporting is about the anger people have at the prices. I wonder, when they go to those gas stations, are they asking people if this is a trade they're willing to make? We asked that on our Unscientific News Click, our little web poll. We said, higher prices, is this a price you're willing to pay for the war that's being waged in Ukraine? And 77% of our respondents said yes. A Reuters poll today shows 63% of Americans approve of cutting off Russian oil in spite of higher prices at the pump. Austin, you ride your bike a lot. Do you even buy gasoline?
I rarely buy gasoline, but it's a really, really important issue. And honestly, at Illinois Policy, we write a lot about tax issues in Illinois. By far, the one that gets people the most animated is the gas tax. And Illinois is home to the second highest gas taxes in the nation when you add up state, local, and federal taxes. In 2019, Governor Pritzker signed into law a doubling of the state gas tax that brought us the second highest in the nation.
We went from 19 to 38 then, right?
Exactly right. And that also hiked the cost of vehicle registration by $50. So you really see in Illinois, and especially in Chicago, some really crazy numbers when you look at the cost of gas and then the cost of the taxes on that gas. So in Chicago, you're looking at like almost half the price, like a 50% effective tax rate on the raw cost of gas in Chicago. These are really absurd numbers. J.B. Pritzker did say that he would like to freeze the gas tax rather than having it automatically go up this summer as it's scheduled to, I believe, July 1st. I think you need to do something much more drastic than that, including repealing that doubling of the state gas tax, because this really, really hurts low-income Illinoisans. And because it's sort of tied to a sales tax price, the tax burden isn't flat. It goes up with when gas prices go up. So Illinoisans are paying a ton for this. I also think it's sort of a false choice when we say, hey, do you either want higher gases or pay money to Russia, higher gas prices or pay money to Russia? There are plenty of things the United States could be doing to become to be a more energy independent nation. Right now, instead of doing things like reopening the next stage of the Keystone Pipeline, the Biden administration is going to countries like Venezuela and saying, hey, can we cut a deal on oil? And I don't think that's in the country's best national security interests to do. And I also think it comes across, like I saw Stephen Colbert on his show basically saying,
today, the average gas price in America hit an all-time record high of over $4 per gallon. That stings, but a clean conscience is worth a buck or two. Hell, I'll pay $15 a gallon because I drive a Tesla.
Americans aren't choosing this. I think if they could choose to have, they can support Ukraine and not get totally killed at the pump.
He described that as an act of conscience and really got ripped on social media for it.
Kind of easy for Colbert to say, right? He's paid $15 million a year. Austin's right that about the gas taxes being high. The problem, of course, is that the road construction industry is firmly against this because we devote so much of our gas tax revenue to rebuilding roads and bridges and so on. The other thing, though, about high gas prices is that it's not only regressive, but it has this sort of compounding effect that you raise prices for gasoline, you also then raise the price of all the vehicles that transport consumer goods from place to place. Your Amazon delivery truck, the UPS truck, you know, the truck that brings the parts to the auto manufacturer, every link in the chain burns fossil fuels. When you raise the price of those, you subtly raise the price of everything. So it's not just the price of gasoline that goes up when you raise the price of gas. It is this compounding effect, which I think we're going to start seeing. That when you ask people, will you pay an extra 75 cents a gallon at the pump, they think, yeah, I'll do that. I'll cut back on my driving. You know, screw Putin. We've got to do something. But this is going to, I think this is going to hurt more than just that 50 cents at the pump, which is a problem that's going to grow as time goes on.
And it's not the tax burden, just to make it in real dollars and cents terms, it's like $15 to $20 every time you fill up your car in Illinois. It's really, really extreme. And I think the other thing, to your point, Eric, about the compounding effects, it's also the only tax that has free billboard space every time someone drives. You always see what the gas price is. It's so top of mind for people it's politically a really, really tough issue. So you're seeing governors like Governor Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan call on a federal gas tax, like an emergency gas tax reduction at the federal level. And I think with the inflation issue, this is going to be one of the most important political issues of the next few months.
One economist told us they think 2 to 3% would be the rise in inflation we would see as a result of these higher gas prices if they stay that way. Imagine how that would impact people's wallets. But I also am hearing that it's not something the president or the governor can do much about. Like, they can maybe roll back taxes, and then that'll be labeled a gimmick. But it's not like Joe Biden or J.B. Pritzker can affect the world demand for a limited commodity, which has been severely restricted right now because Russia has fewer customers. So the demand is still the great, right? You guys tell me if I'm wrong about this, but if the demand is still high and the economy was just roaring along and we were eating up fossil fuel left and right, and suddenly you cut off more than half of the supply of energy, then the price is going to go up. And the XL pipeline doesn't fix that. It's a world market.
But there is a supply part of the equation that we have to be conscious of, right? So I believe, I think The Economist just wrote about this, Western Europe in the not so distant past was producing as much oil as Russia. And those graphs crossed really, in I believe, in the late 2000s, mid to late 2000s. And that is the result of policy choices. And I think rather than and the Biden administration recognizes that supply is the issue because they're going to other countries and saying, hey, we need supply, cut us a deal on oil and gas. The problem is those countries really hate us and we shouldn't be giving them money. And especially when we could increase supply in our own country, I think is the argument.
Then there goes the environment, both the land, the sea, and the air, right, Austin?
Right. The reason that it isn't being done is because there are environmental groups that do have political power that will stop them. Just as not to say the oil and gas industry doesn't have political power. My God, they certainly do. But by and large, there are plenty of technologies that are safe that are not being allowed to take place. I mean, Illinois was actually a prime example. In the heyday of fracking in the United States, Illinois was really, really, really slow and really, really, really wrapped in red tape in terms of being allowed to tap a lot of our reserves in Illinois. And because of the timing of that, we never really got that industry off the ground in Illinois. And that could have been done completely safely and would have helped America's energy independence. But unfortunately, we don't have it here.
I'm not as convinced as Austin is about the complete safety of fracking. There's been a lot of reports on what kind of damage fracking can do to local areas and stuff. But you know, the larger issue, as I think, is we are going to at some point begin to need to wean ourselves from fossil fuels, because if we're not doing business with Russia, we're doing business with the Saudis, we're doing business with Venezuela. And we are going to have to figure out a way not to be dependent on them. And I would hope that some of this electrical generation that we're doing with electric cars and so on will lead the way to that. The problem right now is, of course, far more urgent than that. And we need to figure out whether and hope that these sanctions will begin to put such a squeeze on Putin and Russia that they will back down, because I'm not sure, as I look at what's going on in Ukraine and all the terrible stories coming out of the clearly war crimes being committed, right? How does Russia regain its place in the around the table of civilized nations after what they're doing to civilian citizens in Ukraine? I don't see the end game here playing out well for Russia at all. I don't know what the end game is, what the solution is, but I can't. I don't know how do we can't just say, okay, well, all is forgiven. I think that seems to me like Russia has marginalized itself for a good long time on the world stage.
Don't you hope so? I'm angry not only at Vladimir Putin. I know part of the conversations this week have been, well, but the Russian people they don't have information about what's happening in Ukraine, and some of the soldiers did not realize what they were going to be asked to do. But at the end of the day, that's Russian soldiers firing at Ukraine apartment buildings and hospitals today.
You're completely right about how they've marginalized themselves, and Putin strikes me at the moment as someone who is going to go bust, and the earlier that they cut their losses, the better. But I don't know if he necessarily realizes that. I don't understand what an exit strategy looks like for him right now that leaves him better off today than when he was when he came in.
He reminds me of Trump in that I don't think he's a very good loser. And this is very worrisome because he has nuclear weapons and has intimated, at least slightly, that he might use them. So I think it's a very delicate game of diplomacy and strategy that's going on with not just the United States, but also the European nations trying to figure out how do they give Putin an out without forcing him to humble himself, which he just doesn't seem capable of.
I was talking to Ian Hurd from Northwestern University, who wrote a book about international law and treaties. And I said, you do get to the point where you're like, all right, screw it. Let's at least make Ukraine a no-fly zone. We'll deploy U.S. jets with U.S. pilots in there, and we'll shoot down their aircraft, or we'll provide some sort of air defense for the Ukrainians. You almost wonder.
I hope he told you, John, that that's a really, really bad idea.
He did. And then I said something like, but I think that's where the gut is of some of us. Like, okay, we're not going to do that, but the world could win this war. And yet we're just letting him steamroll through because we're all afraid to engage. But if the United States and Western Europe just fought back, Ukraine would be saved. He said, at what cost?
Yes. Well, and the cost could just be enormous, catastrophic, apocalyptic, doomsday.
That's not what I'm asking for. That's not where that question was going. I know that's ultimately why we're afraid, and that's why we don't do anything. But I think our tanks could beat their tanks, and our pilots could be their pilots, and we could beat them on the Ukrainian front. We could push back. We could win that war. Your witness.
The no-fly zone would risk a World War III like confrontation almost right away. You can't, it's not.
What does that mean, a World War III confrontation?
Well, it means that we would be forced to shoot down Russian planes.
Russian planes, but not Japanese and German planes. Russian planes.
Right, but they would.
Who would be their allies?
Well, right now, China might be their ally. I'm not sure.
I'll bet not, but keep going.
India. I'm not sure exactly where India stands in this right now, but they don't seem to be standing much with NATO. And of course, there's some of the smaller
Belarus,
smaller places. Yeah, but
bring
but,
it.
I mean, when we're talking about world war, when we're talking about world war, we're talking about a war that engulfs and threatens the entire world. I'm not sure we're talking about equal number of players on or teams
well,
on
that,
each side.
I keep cutting you off, Eric, but I just keep thinking in this little fantasy, this just little construct of mine. It's not a drawn-out world war because the world is against Russia. That's kind of my thinking, that it's not a nuclear war and it's not a 10-year war.
Though I think the thrust of Eric's point is just there could be massive unintended consequences and collateral damage of getting into a skirmish of that scale that would affect actual Americans in America. And that's sort of like the only compelling argument I've heard for why Trump was good on foreign relations was the sort of madman theory of international relations, which is that Putin doesn't think Trump is going to bomb Moscow, but he thinks maybe there's a 10% chance that he would. And that affects his actions and the actions of other leaders like him. Similarly, just like what we're talking about with Putin, it's a similar theory, right?
Yeah.
Like we think there's some non-zero chance that he could actually nuke the United States. There is enormous power just in that theory. So, and I don't have a good argument against that. I'm loath to give Trump points on international diplomacy, but that is kind of a good theory.
So do you think Trump was right then when he said recently that this would not have happened on my watch?
This is the argument of those people. And I have to say, if Putin thinks that he's crazy enough to bomb Russia, then Trump would be right, right? Am I missing something?
This is the Kim Jong-un school of international relations, right? Which that's one of the reasons we don't really know what to do with the North Korean leader, is that mm-hmm. he seems just deranged, detached, like that he will fire nuclear. He'd been testing nuclear missiles. Yeah, that he's just the kind of guy who's like, what the hell? I'll just do this. And again, that is kind of the attitude that Trump projected, which is when he would talk about certain policy solutions to things, that it would appear that he just didn't really have a grasp on reality or be able to think more than one chess move ahead. I'm not sure whether this would have happened on Trump's watch or not. It's very hard to tell all the factors that went into Putin's making this decision when he did. But he certainly thought that his army was going to roll in to Ukraine the way our army rolled into Iraq, right? He thought it would be a couple of days and they would take Kyiv and they would take all the major cities and everyone would throw up their hands and Zelensky would be assassinated or exiled and that would be that. Clearly that's not going to happen. And clearly that was a huge miscalculation on his part. And he is in for a long, long, brutal ground war unless he deploys some of these weapons of mass destruction, which, again, he doesn't. Putin does not seem like someone who's going to lose gracefully or look for an exit strategy, that he believes that Ukraine belongs to Russia and he's going to keep at it. And it's very scary, I think, to realize that there doesn't seem to be a neat solution. They keep talking about, well, they're having talks. What's going on in these talks? They make agreements and then break them the next hour. So I don't know where this goes.
Are you heartened by the non-state players that are getting involved, citizens, social media companies, electronics firms, websites, how they are bringing pressure to bear on Putin and Russia?
McDonald's.
For one thing, the SWIFT system, but also cutting off the flow of oil. And then, companies that said Boeing and Aeroflot saying, not Aeroflot, Boeing and what's the other European air manufacturer saying, we're not going to provide parts. We're not going to service the planes. Those that are owned by Irish leasing companies are being recalled at the end of the month. They want their planes back. I mean, the people of Russia are really going to feel this. What's happened to their banking industry is catastrophic for a lot of people. The ruble's worth less than a penny, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, at least everybody is doing everything they can in those regards. And if Coca-Cola or Pepsi or Toyota, sell one more vehicle or one more can of soda or continue operations in that country, we should pay attention to that too.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, sort of speaking in a larger vein about a country like China, and when President Xi there is looking at what's going on in the world and looking at how isolated Russia is and realizing that China's long-term plans really don't involve Russia. They involve, sort of economic domination. And does it really help them to be allied with Russia? Does the kind of chaos that Putin is fomenting really help Xi in his long-term aims? I don't think so. And mm-hmm. I think that when you're thinking about these companies, I'm not sure it was so selfless of McDonald's and these other companies to pull out of Russia. I think they're realizing that if this happens, if Putin, takes Ukraine and then says, well, maybe we should have Poland back, and maybe, and this keeps expanding and sets this precedent, that this is bad for business long term. So I think there's some calculations there by some of these companies, like there is with China, that it's not just a matter of like, we're mad, we're going to do something today. No, they're thinking, what's this going to be like in a year? What's it going to be like in 5 years if we let Putin have his way here?
Well, the world will not be able to buy Chinese goods if the world is engaged in a war, or if the world economies crash because nobody's going to buy Russian oil. I mean, I think you're on to something there, Eric. At the start of last week's podcast, we had just learned that former Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan had been indicted by the U.S. Attorney's Office on 22 counts of racketeering. Today, his arraignment was done over the phone. The feds wanted him at the courthouse in person, but he was able to do it over the phone. He's pleading not guilty to all of the counts. Is there any question, and this is not a rhetorical question, guys, about what is and is not fair horse trading? You know, you need something, I need something, you do this for me, I'll do that for you. Is it possible that Madigan actually thought, and this is what he's pleading, that this isn't a crime, this is how we do business in Illinois?
And this is the argument that was launched, of course, by Governor Blagojevich's defense team, which was, this is just horse trading, right? I take this, and there is some truth to that, which is that this does happen in politics, where you will, you know, they scratch each other's backs in some ways, and at some point it comes up to the line of a quid pro quo, and then it crosses the line into a crime. As long as you give these politicians the ability to hire and fire and, you know, control jobs and have these patronage positions and have the kind of power that they do, you're going to have this kind of, you know, I'll do this for you if you do this for me. And I don't think that Madigan thought this was all on the up and up. I think that's probably why he had so many layers of insulation around him, why he never talked on the phone, why he didn't use email. I think he knew that there was shady dealings going on. I don't know how successful his defense attorneys are going to be persuading a jury that that's the case. We'll see, maybe in a couple of years when this goes to trial. But I think there's a decent chance that there won't be we don't have the, you know, it's effing golden kind of audio recordings. As far as we know, we don't have anything like that with Madigan. So it may come down to some interesting testimony and feelings of people saying, well, I thought this is what he wanted, and he implied this, and his defense attorneys are going to say, you know, he implied it, but maybe he was not implying it. I think this case is not a slam dunk as far as I read that indictment, but Austin may see it differently.
Yeah, I mean, there's one part where Solis is, I don't know if he's on the phone or in person with Madigan, and he's talking about the Chinatown land deal. And for people not familiar with the case, there was a state-owned piece of land in the Chinatown neighborhood of Chicago. It was a parking lot. There were some developers who wanted to purchase that land from the state and build a hotel. So they went to Alderman Danny Solis, who was the chair of the zoning committee, and as this indictment alleges, sort of a bag man for Madigan. He would make zoning changes so long as the people would hire Madigan's property tax appeals firm. And that was really the case, they allege, with this Chinatown parcel, where the developers were lobbying Solis sort of for the zoning change. Solis went to Madigan, they met with him and the developers at his property tax appeals office. And then there was legislation filed. It did not pass, but there was legislation filed with Madigan's knowledge and sort of nod to allow the state to sell that piece of land. And we have Solis on tape saying, quote, I think they understand how this works. You know, the quid pro quo. And Madigan responds, quote, okay, very good. First of all, Madigan has lost a step if he is saying to someone out loud that he is doing a, quote, quid pro quo yeah, deal right. with another politician. Like, that is just so stupid. But clearly there's some quid pro quo going on.
But then doesn't he say not to say quid pro quo at some point? Isn't there some point in the evidence where he says, but don't say quid pro quo, right?
Don't call it that. Right. Yeah. I think Madigan's a great, if you could call it that, innovation in the patronage game was the Mayor Daley patronage army was very straightforward. It was, you're in a public sector job. You will keep your job if you go knock doors for me, if you vote for me, if you give me money. It was very simple corruption. Like, that was the patronage machine. That kind of died in the 70s and early 80s because of the what are called the Shachtman decrees, which banned political patronage hiring in Illinois. What Madigan did instead of that was essentially used other things as proxies. So like ComEd, he got to name a board seat at ComEd. These are entities that need something from government, and he was able to put, in a sense, patronage hires in those things. It was the same way he operated with the head of private and public sector union leaders. basically they would give him political muscle and money and he would act on their behalf. It was a different kind of patronage, but I think it's still at its heart a quid pro quo of some kind.
I'm interested in what Eric suggests, though, that shy of, and maybe that quid pro quo will be his doom, but do you agree, Austin, with Eric, that
it's not
a slam dunk?
It's a really hard case. Like we saw this in New York. The former House Speaker in New York was also charged with racketeering, but that case went on like a decade. Like it just didn't end. There was constant appeals, and then it's just all sorts of weird procedural stuff. It's going to take a really long time for any of us to have any kind of resolution.
I asked Austin if he knew who the interns were.
Yeah, I mean, there was essentially like, you know how some places have like a name, like a special intern program. ComEd had basically like the Friends of Mike Madigan intern program alleged in this indictment. And we don't know who they were. And honestly, I don't think we should be.
I want to know.
If you're some 18-year-old kid from the 13th ward who, you know, picks up trash on the weekend, so Madigan was like, hey, you've got a good jawline, you could go to ComEd. Like, I don't think that's necessarily fair. But I did say my recommendation, John, was that we do have a statue of the nameless intern.
Of the unnamed intern? Yeah, right, yeah. Exactly. The mayor and the police chief were at a red line stop today talking about safety on the CTA. The mayor did not use any bad language that I was able to hear. I monitored about 30 minutes of it, though sometimes she does. Last week, we learned that she was very angry at plans to unveil the city's Christopher Columbus statue at the end of the Columbus Day parade. The statue was put away last year after it was the site of protests and vandalism. A committee is reviewing the appropriateness of the Columbus statue and other statues in the city. But the mayor was angry that even this temporary display at the end of the parade was being negotiated without her knowledge or consent. To a city attorney, she wrote, "You make some kind of agreement with Italians. You are out there stroking your D-I-C-K, I'll say." Eric said spine when we talked about this on the radio. He kept substituting the word spine. You're out there stroking yourself over the Columbus statue, and I'm trying to keep Chicago police from being shot. My D-I-C-K, Lori Lightfoot said to this attorney, is bigger than yours and the Italians. I have the biggest one in Chicago. Now she's getting sued for her remarks.
Do we have those in writing? Isn't that what she is alleged to have said?
She was asked about that at the press conference today, wasn't she, Eric?
Well, she was asked about it. And once again, her denial was not, it was sounded full-throated. She said that she rejects the allegations as ridiculous.
Yeah.
But she never said, "I never said that."
Well, it sounds like her. I mean, this is very plausible.
It certainly does.
Lori Lightfoot. Well,
and she pivots to saying that she does not have any beef with the Italian Americans. That this is not an attack on Italian. And it is. You read the remarks as alleged. She's just saying that her spine is bigger than the other lawyers and the Italians, that she is tougher than the Italians. It doesn't necessarily, it's a slam on the Italians. The lawyer she's talking to, I think, is of Greek descent at the time. And I think the answer to Austin's question is no, we don't have this in writing, and I don't know if we have a recording. The transcript or the quotation in the suit is tellingly specific. It's not like she said this word. She said it is a sort of a long paragraph in quote mark, direct quotations. It suggests that maybe there's a recording of this. Now, I don't know what the law would be. I think there were three people in this conversation. And if you need all party consent, if the mayor could say that this is not allowed, but of course, in the court of public opinion, a recording might exist. And if that recording gets out, it doesn't matter whether it was a legal recording or not. The mayor's got to be careful. If she denies categorically using this language, then she is really going to be in trouble, which is why I suspect she hasn't come out and said, "I never said I have the biggest spine in Chicago. I never said that."
Well, if the transcript is accurate and somebody can prove it, then should she own it? She go, "Yeah, I was ticked because you know what? And then here's my rash. Here's why I was angry."
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think she could say, "Look, I use bad language when I'm angry, and I was really angry, and you can tell why. This was not meant for public consumption, and I regret that it has been made public. Make of it what you will. That's what, if I were advising her, and it's true, then if this guy's making it up, then yeah, deny it. But if it is true, or she thinks it might be true, she should probably just own it and say, yeah, I was mad, and here's why I was mad, and not do this kind of squirrely way she's trying to semi-deny what she said.
I was surprised by how many, especially women I spoke to about this, were like, you go get him. Like, men talk like this all the time. Why shouldn't the mayor, like, why shouldn't Lori Lightfoot be able to talk like this? And my favorite reaction was from my colleague who runs digital at Illinois Policy, Vincent Caruso, an Italian man in Chicago, said it's about time somebody stood up to the Italians in Chicago. And that was his reaction. But I think it's totally in line with this terrible, we would call it, in Latin America, there's something called a caudillo, which is like sort of a big strongman leader. And those are the folks who take over many of these countries, often a military coup. And there's a political culture that selects for these people that sort of act and talk this way, that they are the big boss. And we certainly have that in Chicago and in our kind of structure of government that gives so much power to the mayor back set up.
What a funny thing to flex your muscle over, too. I mean, I guess you really, Lori, you want to get involved in what's the last trailer in the Columbus Day parade, and it's going to be the Columbus statue. Why are you so vexed by that? Why does she care?
Totally.
Well, I think she's mad that they went behind her back. They didn't get her sign off on this. And it was, if you remember, this whole Columbus statue stuff was very fraught. And, you know, there were protests around the statue. I think a police officer or was injured, and maybe one of the protesters was injured.
It was a
rough time. So I think she thought that this might, and I get it, as a mayor, she's got to decide whether this is a good idea, a bad idea. I'm not so sure it would have been a terrible idea. It might have been looking like a finger in the eye to the mayor to have the statue unveiled. They were going to unveil it at the end of the parade. But I do understand why she would want to be in on that at the very least.
Well, that's it. So if when they unveiled the statue, Eric, do you think that was them saying, okay, F you, and we've still got our statue? Or was that just a way to celebrate Columbus and their heritage?
I'm trying to imagine it, and that's kind of how it would feel like to me as an observer. I would feel like them saying, nan, nan, a boo, boo, here's our statue, and we're going to show it off. And I don't think the mayor wanted that. And I think that was her prerogative, and it's her prerogative to be angry. And she used colorful language that I think a lot of people secretly are saying, like, you go, Mayor Lightfoot, that's a slice of humanity. And, you know, the point that I think you and I were talking about on the radio the other day, John, was that there's some ways in which it's sexist for her to use a male appendage to signify strength. It's like when Governor Blagojevich talked about his testicular virility, and people talk about male genital attributes as being symbols of strength.
Donald Trump did that at a debate, remember, and everybody seemed to love it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and that is sexist to say, like, well, you know, because you're talking not about physical strength, or you're talking about emotional, moral rigor. You're not talking about, you know, being able to lift up the end of a car or something like that. So to equate that kind of strength, that kind of fortitude with masculinity is sexist, right?
She should have said, I have the biggest suits in Chicago or something, something non-gendered. Because she does have big suits.
Bigger than the Italian suits.
Bigger than the Italians. Yeah.
Beyond that, I just wonder if that's even an effective way to run your office. You're the most powerful person in the city. You get to say that, and you get to kill the Columbus statue in the Columbus parade if you want to, because you are, what's that word in the Latin American culture?
Caudillo. Caudillo.
You're the statue caudillo. Hooray for you, right? But I mean, I don't know that that's a good use of your power. I don't know if that's a good way to win friends and influence people.
I don't know if you guys have been in workplaces with people who talk like that, but they're invariably the weakest, most emotionally fragile, terrible leaders there are. It's like an inverse correlation with people who talk that way in a work environment and their efficacy as a leader, in my experience.
Yeah, and although I sort of enjoyed the colorful nature of her diatribe, or alleged diatribe, I also think that it plays into what people perceive as her weakness, which is that she doesn't get get along with others. She doesn't. What was the Alderman Sanchez? Was it last week we talked about this, where she said, you know, that the mayor has managed to piss off everyone she deals with, you know, teachers, firemen, police officers, other council members. Everybody who deals with her comes away thinking that she's an unpleasant person, hard to deal with. And so this plays into that, which is like, this is someone who's very thin-skinned and irascible, and that's not how you get things done. And it's not necessarily, as Austin points out, the quality in a good leader. Leaders tend to be more measured. And, you know, people have a lot of bad things to say about Rahm Emanuel, but Emanuel was, we use colorful language, but he always felt like he was in control. Like, he was very strategic in his use of,
and he was funny,
obscenities
too. And he could own the room, where I don't know that Lori ever warms a room anymore. I don't know what the armchair psychologist would say about that. Like, where does that come from? Have you felt marginalized enough in your life that once you receive the rung, that you are going to hold on to it and defend it so fiercely that you're kind of pulling yourself down in the process? Any repercussions? You know, my news click was asking people if this would affect how you feel about her if the election were tomorrow, and people didn't seem to crush her on that. I think I'm looking at Pete now, but it was like you had three options: I'm more likely, less likely, or as likely to vote for as I was in the past. And it was about 20 and 20 on the ends and about 50 or 60 in the middle, something like that.
And again, certainly a different mayor at a different time, I think it would have played better. This was not a great time for her to do this. It seems like a lot of people are now lining up to perhaps get into the race. The Sun, Fran Spielman this morning had a real good piece in the Sun Times where she listed people who she thought were the top contenders for mayor. And the suggestion was floated that the fact that Arne Duncan dropped out of the 2023 mayoral race, so the sweepstakes, I should say, at this point, just, you know, who's jockeying for position, might end up playing poorly for Lightfoot, because when she had one major opponent, supposed to be Duncan, to have a contrast, maybe get into a runoff. But now you may have 10, 15 people who are all vying to knock her off. And given her popularity rating is somewhere within about 30%, she might not even make a runoff at this point. It might end up being two other people. And then now they're talking about perhaps Congressman Quigley getting into the race. He certainly didn't deny it in talking to Spielman. And so that's all shaping up to be maybe a more interesting and more challenging race for her now than it was a week ago.
She was at a press conference today with David Brown at a red line stop. Austin, I was so encouraged when you said to me the other day in a text that, was it the Brown line that you take?
Mm-hmm.
That your Brown line CTA train was pretty packed. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. And that was on Monday when we had that brief blizzard. So I didn't bike into the loop, and I took the Brown line into the loop from Lincoln Park. And it wasn't packed like a Brown line train in 2019 would be at 7:30 a.m. It wasn't bumper to bumper. Trains weren't going by full of people.
Yeah.
But it was like standing room only on a Brown line car, which I had not experienced in 2 years.
I'm
I don't know
so
if you've seen that on the red line.
No,
track, but it was shocking to me.
Okay, so my producer Pete does take the red line. He takes it from almost the end on the north side down to not Grand, but Lake Street, the next stop. So right downtown. And he said the seats are all taken and some people are standing in the middle. When I was riding it last year, I used to count the people, and the sleepers were outnumbering, you know, the homeless people were outnumbering the people that were commuting to work. I'm so glad to hear that.
And I was surprised that her press conference today was about sort of CTA safety. And the biggest thing to do for the safety of CTA is like get people back to work downtown, have people on the trains. They don't need to be cops. Just a certain number of people will keep them.
They said they're going to double the number of unarmed security guards. The police are going to have a bigger presence around the CTA stops and on the platforms. I'm not convinced that they have a plan. They're going to throw more people at it. I'm not sure what they can do about it, but I'm not persuaded that they are as committed to that as I want them to be.
But security personnel, just adding security personnel is a plan, I believe. I think that when you have – one of the odd things about riding the CTA in recent years has been the fact that there's absolutely nobody but the motorman or motorwoman at the front of the train. keeping track of anything that's going on. And this feeling of like, you're on your own if anything goes wrong. There's nobody to help you out. There's nobody even that for out-of-towners to ask what that silly little spaghetti map means on the wall. So I think it's a good thing in a number of ways. And is it going to solve the problem? Totally no. But I think it will cut down if you have people who look like security guards, who are on these trains, who are keeping an eye out for, and that they're going to recognize certain people who come onto the trains who they've seen before, who are pickpockets and phone thieves and so on. So I think that, I don't know, you have to have a strategic plan where you've got people deployed here and there is so important. It's just sheer numbers is going to make a difference, I think. I hope.
I want an attendant on every train. And I was told that's just way too expensive. You got one guy driving the train, one gal driving the train, but you can't have somebody like on Metra walking the length of the train taking your tickets. You can't have somebody just walk the length of the train as it's going up and down the red line. The manpower would be too expensive.
I believe they used to have that, though, didn't they?
Not in my experience, really.
Well, it's been a while, but I seem to remember that there used to be two CTA personnel on every train. But maybe I'm fantasizing about that, but that's my memory.
There's a really popular Reddit post right now about this, about safety on the red line. Here's what you do to be safe on the red line. The guy said, okay, the first thing you do is you only ride the first car. He said, if poop's going to go down, it's going to go down with me and the driver of the train. Number two, never make eye contact with people if you think there's something sketchy. And if there's something sketchy, he said, there's something sketchy. He said, if somebody is smoking or playing music loudly on the train, they're not supposed to either of those, do not intervene. You know, there is a button you can push on the train if there's action.
But isn't that like one of those elevator buttons that doesn't actually do anything? Or the crosswalk button that you press? And that's like,
I think
makes
the guard
feel better.
But if you hit that and they see you hitting that, they being the bad guys, maybe you've just put yourself in harm's way now because you're telling on them. You're going to get them arrested, and maybe they don't appreciate that. So nobody hit it the one time I was in a scene like this because everybody was afraid to hit the red button.
It's sort of an element of you're like shooting up a red flare right in front of someone who's mugging someone, which doesn't bode well for you. And it's not like, even if you call the conductor, what are they going to do?
Yeah.
You know, that's, and also if you're on a moving train, you're not at a stop. It doesn't seem effective whatsoever. I think the best thing is get people back on the trains, and hopefully some of them, you know karate or are, you know, good Samaritans and can stop crying.
No karate? Wait, you're recommending that we don't use jujitsu or karate on these guys as they
try? No, we should. No. Like they.
Oh, K-N-O-W. Yes.
Yeah.
Learn karate.
They're trained karate masters. Yeah.
Weren't the Guardian Angels in Chicago at some point in the last couple of decades? I seem to remember some brief presence where the Guardian Angels came here. But you really do need, I think, to have two people on every train. That doesn't see. I know it's more expensive, and maybe it's just not doable. But
that would make me feel better. That would sure make me want to get back on that.
And I certainly hope that they continue a mask mandate on the train for as long as possible, because the way those trains can get packed at rush hour, having people breathing on each other, not a good idea.
I think I will continue wearing. Yeah, people were complying with that. I didn't see actually. Now that I'm thinking about it, I don't think I saw a single person without a mask. I will probably, like in most indoor settings, I'm not really wearing a mask right now. But on the train, I will probably keep wearing one throughout the winter, long past COVID.
Producer Pete, were they wearing the mask on your red line train as well? It's pretty masked up. That's a thumbs up over there. One last thing then, guys. Speaking of the masks, the Chicago Public Schools and the Chicago's Teachers Union are supposed to. Let's see, is it this coming Monday or was it
coming Monday? I believe
this coming Monday
the end.
Is the end of the mask mandate. And the CTU evidently was not consulted on this. Don't they have a contract, the CPS and the CTU, that says the safety protocols will include masks? And the Chicago Public Schools said, we're going to make an executive decision here. If we negotiate a new version of this, hell, the school will be over by the time we get that hammered out. So in the name of safety, and since everybody else is saying we don't have to wear a mask, masks are now optional in the schools. And the CTU says they're going to fight it.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, it's true. There's an agreement between the CTU and CPS. But the problem with that is, as you said, bargaining for a new agreement, it's not just about bargaining for a new agreement. It wouldn't just be about the mask agreement. There is a whole philosophy around CTU's bargaining. It sort of came in when the new kind of radical they're called the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, was elected to all of the union positions in 2010. That's where folks like Jesse Sharkey came out of, Karen Lewis. It was a new, very political, very militant movement within the CTU. And the philosophy is called bargaining for the common good, which means you're at the bargaining table, you actually have a responsibility on a huge number of issues affecting the city to bargain on those and use all of the power in your might to create some sort of policy change or social change in your bargaining. So it's not as simple as like, hey, they really should have told us about that before they did it. No, if they go back to the bargaining table, it's going to be a huge laundry list of other stuff. It always is. So I understand that, yes, there's a contract in place, but I don't think it's as easy as saying, wow, this is really bad faith by CPS. They should have gone and, you know, told us about this and bargained with us.
It seems to me that the CTU is correct in their interpretation. I mean, they had an agreement. They struck a deal with the schools about mask mandates and safety toward the end of the year. Things have changed since then. I think that the better part of valor would be for the CTU to step back and agree to lifting the mask mandate at most schools. Now, there are some schools, and they talk about them. I heard Jesse Sharkey talking on the John Williams show the other day, and he was talking about there are certain schools where the vaccination rate is really low, or there are vulnerable students in these schools or vulnerable teachers, and sort of just all of a sudden one day rip the Band-Aid off completely and say no masks are required anywhere is going too far. But that this ought to be something that they could that reasonable people could work out, that the schools could say, yeah, we made this deal, things have changed, can we just like grown-ups sit down and figure out a way to accommodate your concerns? And I think the teachers do have some rational concerns. I think they're probably overreacting a little bit, but you know, they've gained this territory, they're going to hang on to it. I'd like to think that they could get these adults in the room and they could figure this out and say, you know, we'll lift the mask mandate in most places, and in certain other places we'll do it differently. And they could probably figure that out in a good long evening with a big pot of coffee, I would hope, anyway.
Or some beers, maybe. I like Jesse Sharkey. I find him to be generally pretty reasonable. I know he said some incendiary things here and there, but mostly I think he's been good on the radio. I'll say that. You know, he's been accessible.
He's been good for radio.
Well, yeah. Because he's accessible and he doesn't tick everybody off so much that they want to turn the radio off.
Well, maybe he'll run for mayor, you know?
Yeah, and I haven't heard that he is going to, but I think that would be interesting. What would be difficult is, I was just looking at this today for something I was working on. In November of 2020, there was a letter from all the Chicago labor unions that said Chicago Federation of Labor, SEIU, CTU, all the big labor players, basically saying, and this was, by the way, after the deferred prosecution agreement with ComEd, where ComEd admitted that they tried to bribe Mike Madigan. It was after some Democratic state lawmaker said, we're not going to have this guy as speaker anymore. They basically wrote a letter that said, Mike Madigan's our guy. We're standing by him. This guy fights for working people. And Jesse Sharkey's name right on there.
Really?
That's going to be a problem for him if he runs.
Well, I mean, what Austin forgets is that Madigan did have a lot of influence, a lot of power, a lot of friends, particularly in organized labor, because he was so strongly behind public sector unions. And yeah, that's something that the public sector unions now have to deal with going forward. Everybody who was part of that probably has some connections to Madigan. One of the people who I think would be probably a pretty good mayor of Chicago, and someone who I like as a public office holder, is Susana Mendoza, the state controller. And yet, her connections to Alderman Burke just killed her. And she's also known as an ally of Madigan's back in the old days. And so I think that her prospects for higher office are probably limited. She may be able to stay as controller for as long as she wants, but as far as moving up to governor or moving up to mayor, I don't think that's going to happen because of those connections. So
was Madigan
the taint goes on.
Yeah, well, so was Madigan toxic enough that this is going to be a sea change? The Republicans are really going to gain some ground in the next election?
They were already set to before the Madigan indictment. I mean, it's real, and any poll I've seen in almost any state is predicting something similar to 1994, where there's just a massive red wave for a number of reasons. I think the Madigan stuff makes it that was such a gift to Republicans running. It's just another sort of cherry on top. So I think it's going to be a massive campaign talking point. Basically every sitting Democrat in the Illinois House has some kind of connection to Madigan or voted for him for speaker.
They're going to yoke Madigan to every Democrat running. It's going to be, do you want to vote for the Madigan Pritzker agenda? Do you want to vote for, you know, anybody who's running for anything? The Madigan-Frerichs agenda.
There are only 19 Democrats. Was that the number?
Yes, but even those 19, some of them have voted for him previously, and most of them took money from him at some point. So I think even for those people, it's going to be hard. They'll have to, you know, answer tons of questions about Madigan. They'll have a better answer.
Finish that sentence for me, though. There were only 19. What am I recalling? What's the 19?
So 19 Democrats essentially came out. This was while Madigan was speaker. And they came out and they said, before the January election for House Speaker, they said, we will not vote for Mike Madigan for speaker. And we're staying firm on that. And that was basically a critical mass where everybody else had to say, okay, we have to find another speaker that everybody's okay with. And that was Chris Welch.
But only 19 stood up to him.
But ultimately, everyone voted for Welch. There weren't other people who were on record for voting for Madigan that year.
Can I give you guys one TV watching suggestion? On Hulu, The Dropout, 8 episodes. It's on Disney Plus 2, I think, about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. It's not a documentary. It's kind of a docudrama. Watched the first episode the other night. It's kind of been a subject of mine. Really, really liked it. And then Winning Time on HBO, 10 episodes about Magic Johnson and the Lakers, about him leaving Michigan State after college and going on to play for the Lakers and what that was like. Winning Time. It should have been called Showtime, but because that's what it was when Kareem and Magic were playing basketball, but Showtime's a competing network for HBO, so they called it Winning Time, which is a stupid name for the show. But Winning Time and The Dropout, so far, I'm giving them thumbs up.
I'll add After Party on Apple TV. It's a fun little series, inventive. I mean, it's sort of a whodunit, but the whodunit is almost beside the point. And then Afterlife, the Ricky Gervais vehicle, which is on Netflix. So my after recommendation.
Yes, there's a theme there, isn't there? Yeah.
Both are limited series, so and very enjoyable, I think.
Yeah, both of mine are kind of docudramas. What about you, Austin?
I have not finished the third and final installment of this yet, but the Kanye West documentary Genius on Netflix is amazing. It's by far the best hip hop documentary I've seen, and is one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. I think in 50 years, when people say, how did rap come to dominate culture, this will be one of the things that people watch. It's incredible, especially because you have someone who's followed him really with a camera since he was 19. And Kanye West, when he was 19, was just as confident in himself as Kanye West now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's really interesting. It's like if you had, someone following Jordan with a camera when he got cut from his high school basketball team or something, you see him sort of deal with these struggles early on in his career. It's really, really, really good.
I found, though, his confidence when he was young, when we were just learning who Kanye West was kind of charming and fun. And, you know, he talked the talk, but he could walk the walk. He was really good. And now it's kind of like you wonder about his mental stability.
He just put out a video showing himself killing Pete Davidson. Animated fantasy. But remember what they did to Kathy Griffin, the comedian who was just held up a mock severed head of Donald Trump. She basically lost her career for several years over that. Can get away with putting out a video of him trying to kill Pete Davidson, a romantic rival.
It's sort of at the point where he proved everybody wrong that he couldn't be a successful rapper. And, he gives this fantastic speech at the Grammys, basically saying, people were asking me what would happen if I didn't win. Well, I guess we'll never know. And then he drops the mic and leaves the stage. So it's kind of, we're kind of at that point. We haven't got to the point where he's truly, you know, the number one celebrity in America. But I think people who watch it will come away with a different perception of him, and especially his mom, who, as much as Kanye West believes in himself, his mom was this like emotional savant who kind of believed in him even more and was even more loving to him and more supportive. And she's a really, really interesting character, too.
That's Austin Berg and Eric Zorn. We have a cast of other Mincing Rascals who couldn't join us today. Some of them were doing their jobs, like following the Lori Lightfoot, David Brown press conference.
That's unforgivable, doing their jobs.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you guys, including our podcast and yours. Thanks for joining us today. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we will drop another podcast on you next week.
So I just realized I didn't plug in my microphone, so you're hearing me through my MacBook mic, I think.
Oh, no, you sound good. But you know what? I was speaking of plugging, I was going to tell you to plug your video or your website more specifically.
Yeah, I also started a podcast that I should plug.
Well, really?
I'll talk about it next week, yeah.
Is it by yourself, or who do you do it with?
It's by myself.
Are you serious?
Interviewing people, yeah. It's posted everywhere. It's called America's Talking. I'll put an episode here. This episode I really liked. And it's basically a project. So, you know, the Center Square, which does State House News, their parent organization is called Franklin News Foundation, which is a nonprofit. This is a network. This is like their podcast network. So I have the show for their podcast network called America's Talking.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.